Welcome to Morph Into a New You, part of MHNRnetwork.com. Your host, Johnny Calloway, is the author of several books, including Taming the Dragon, Dragons to Butterflies, The Metamorphosis of a Man, and The Bridge. He will be having conversations with people from all walks of life. Healing really is an inside job that transforms you to become a better version of you. We must change our self-talk and inner dialogue so we can start to believe. A special thanks to our sponsor, Meaningful Expressions, at m-expressions.com. They can take a concept, thought, or personal brand and turn it into a visual masterpiece that you can use to raise awareness about your passion or cause. They've certainly done that with our podcast website. And thank you for joining Johnny as you morph into a new you.
Hello, everybody. This is Johnny Calloway, host of Morph Into a New You and author of Dragons to Butterflies and Metamorphosis of a Man. On this show, we talk about the blocks that keep us from being our real self and then we discover ways to eliminate those blocks. And we have a master at that on the show with us today, and that's Dr. Michael Rice. I met Michael back in 1990 in West Palm Beach, Florida, while he was giving one of his talks. And shortly after that, I moved up and lived with him in the Ozark Mountains at a place, his place called Heartland. We did a lot of intense work there around my healing process, my recovery process, and my forgiveness. And I'm going to have Michael tell you about his book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again, and about himself. And hi, Michael, how are you doing today?
I'm rocking, ready to go.
Ready to go.
Glad to be here.
All right, Michael, tell us a little about yourself and your book and Heartland.
Well, you know, there's not a lot to tell about me, just that I chose almost 50 years ago to pick up and start to look at why is this happening to me again. During my birthing process, they called my father in the middle of the night and told him he better get down there because this kid wasn't going to survive till morning. And the next 25 years or so, I lived on an inhalator and pills. And I realized that that was not, while it was keeping me alive, it wasn't healing me, it was killing me. So I started to search for alternatives to healing, became a naturopathic physician, and then was introduced to the first century Aramaic teachings of the man named Yeshua, the man who's classically called Jesus, but his name wasn't Jesus, it was Yeshua. And in the Aramaic, what was clear to me is this was a complete system of healing that included a deep understanding of quantum physics, of psychology, of genetics, and physiology. And so I began to work, you know, with my background in medicine and electronics, began to work with that understanding and developed a core tool based on what I learned from the first century Aramaic of forgiveness. And I refer to it generally as first century Aramaic forgiveness because there is no forgiveness on planet Earth today. What's called forgiveness in our culture today is a Greek idea of pardoning. In other words, the Greeks put it like this. Johnny, you know, you did something really terrible that caused all this pain inside of me, but it's okay. I'll forgive you. I'll let you off the hook for what's going on inside of me. And if I let you off the hook for what's going on inside of me, I've done absolutely nothing to address what's going on inside of me. And if I never address and change what's going on inside of me, I'll get to live the title of my book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? So in the first century, the Aramaic term forgiveness has nothing whatsoever to do with letting somebody else off the hook because they've done something that they shouldn't have done, and I'm in pain. If I choose, because you've done something untoward, to let you off the hook, then I have pardoned you, which is a nice thing. And it can have some benefits, because if I've hooked my pain up to my brain's image of you, then whenever I'm in your presence, I'm going to be experiencing pain. Now, if I live in a state of denial, and the work that I've developed, the word denial has a very specific meaning. When I think or speak as though something inside of me is going on because of something outside of me, I'm in denial. And when I speak or think words like, you made me mad, you made me sad, you hurt me. Anybody in the audience ever say, you really have a problem? Well, I have a question. If they're the one with the problem, why are you the one with the pain? Something about that doesn't make sense. If they're the one with the problem, they'd be the one with the pain. Maybe if you've got pain and you think it's caused by someone else, you're in denial. And what happens when you live in denial is that you dissociate from the contents of your own mind. And now it's no longer yours to change. So the whole culture has been fooled into letting other people off the hook because they have no access to the root of their own pain and therefore no way to remove it. The man named Yeshua 2,000 years ago had a specific step-by-step technology. Here's how you collapse the lies in your mind of believing that everybody else is the problem. You get to the root of your pain, and when you bring that pain forward in the presence of active love, then your pain begins to dissolve, and that's the act of forgiveness. So people will say, well, but Michael, I already forgave them. And I say, please don't forgive anybody ever again. Don't ever forgive yourself because you can't. If you choose to pardon somebody or yourself, wonderful. Then go about the work of forgiveness, and that is getting to the root of your own pain, getting out of your dissociated state, and change the root of your pain by forgiveness. And then you won't be projecting it into your brain's image of others and believing that it's all everybody else's fault. So never forgive anybody, ever.
That really, I think that ties into what my experience has been. And part of my belief is the way that what I think I've learned from watching other people with forgiveness and myself is that most people seem to approach the idea of forgiveness as we're acquiring the ability to tolerate someone. It's like, okay, you can live here now. I'll let you be here. And I feel today, in my understanding of it, what it really is when I acquire the ability to appreciate someone. I know for me, with what I've always believed was my forgiveness of my father, was when I learned to appreciate how he helped me to learn and to grow, even though it was not his quote unquote physical intention, but that is what I got as a gift from him. Does that tie you?
So my input would be, well, in a sense, my take would be, listening to your words, is that what happened is when you finally got to the point where you had removed a sufficient amount of pain that you had related to your father, then you could see father as the man that he was, efforting, trying, doing the best he could, whatever was going on for him, and you were able to be the true Johnny Calloway, the presence of love, because you had forgiven or removed your pain.
Right.
Now, and when that happens, we return to the essence of who we are. You know, have you ever held a newborn child?
Yes.
Okay. If you go back to the moment where you held that newborn and you were to tap into the essence of the newborn, what word would you use to describe that newborn?
Wow. Alive would be my first word.
Mm-hmm.
Joy would be what it would bring up for me.
That's the newborn.
What I feel is joy.
Right. That's your feeling, but we're looking to tap into the essence of the newborn. And I'll just offer that, you know, over the years, I've invited tens of thousands of people to share what their word would be for the essence of the newborn. And everybody's word is always some variation on the theme of love.
Right.
Now, if you think about that, go back to the moment where you held that newborn. Is the newborn loving you?
I think no. The newborn just is
no.
Love. But
there
no.
You go. So guess who Johnny is? Guess who you are?
I'm love.
You're that newborn.
Right.
And when you can be that in the presence of the perp or the offender, then you can embrace them in that love, and you're not in pain because you've freed yourself of pain. You haven't forgiven them. If you go back to the Aramaic, what you've done is you've removed. If you substitute the word removal for forgiveness, we're now on track for what forgiveness is. It's the removal of that pain. And when I remove that pain, then I'm able to stand as the human being I was born to be, rather than the pain that I've associated with in my body's mind.
And the stories that I've made up around the pain to justify the pain, right?
Exactly.
So then once I remove the stories, or, you know, in A Course in Miracles, one of the lessons is I'm determined to see this differently. And once I've removed the pain, I become capable of seeing it differently. Correct?
Exactly. Because instead of, you know, instead of your perception, the construct of your mind coming from what's stored in the body from the past and its pain and its trauma and its generations of whatever's going on, at that moment, your perceptual construct comes from being. It comes from your human life, which is love. And when that is what drives the whole perceptual system, instead of the content of this body-mind unit from the past, we're living in a different world. Let's say I put a dozen people in a room, and I have somebody come up to the front of the room and do something that everybody agrees is really terrible. Now, each one of them will say, when that guy did that, one will say, he made me angry. The other will say, he made me afraid. The other one, he just made me go to tears and shattered me, and I ran out of the room. Everybody will have a different story about what that person did to them. But the truth is, that person just did what they did. And the reason everybody's story is different because the content of everybody's body-mind unit is different. And the only thing that can take a person out of the truth of who they are as that essence of love is the content of their own minds, their own story. So one person says he made me sad. That person, what he did had nothing to do with your sadness. You're sad because they're sad in your mind, not because he did what he did. Another says that enraged me. You know, you're not enraged because of what he did. You're enraged because there's rage in you. Forgive your sadness, forgive your rage, forgive your hatred, forgive your fear, and now you function as a human being. Now, what takes us out of that state of love? It's the content of the body's mind. Now, if you talk to a modern day physiologist, they'll tell you that the basic element of your body is carbon. Now, you get to live in one of two minds. You either live in the mind of being, which in the ancient teachings was called the mind of Christ, which means in Aramaic, Christ means a direct channel to love, to God. You either live in that mind or you live in the mind of your body with its content from the past, generations and generations and generations of past. You've got two choices. One of them was called the mind of Christ. The other one was called the antichrist, that which goes against living as love. Now, if you ask that physiologist what carbon's made of, they'll tell you that it's made of 6 electrons, 6 protons, 6 neutrons, 666, the antichrist. Now, everybody's out there chasing the guy with the red suit, the tail, and the pitchfork when it's all an inside job. We've externalized that and made it something outside of us, but it's the content of our own carbon-based memory. Our body-mind units are carbon-based devices. It's those things stored from the generations. And if you go back to the Aramaic word sin, sin is an archery term. It's got nothing to do with the Greek idea of something terrible, awful, evil, nasty, wicked that you did. It just means, you know, when somebody was on the archery range and fired at the target and missed the bullseye, the scorekeeper yelled, sin, you're off the mark. That's all it means. And so when they said the sins of the fathers would be passed into 3 and 4 generations, what they were saying is that every energetic experience that you and I have is stored holographically in every cell in our structure, including the sperm and the egg. And so were you to conceive a child tomorrow, that child would have in its structure every thought you've ever thought, every feeling you've ever felt, every reality you've ever engaged in, everything that's unresolved in your life. So these hostilities and fears are generational. You know, that story of the Jews wandering in the desert for 40 years. You know, you got to think about that for a minute. Here's this group of people. It's obviously pretty bright. And they're lost in a 30-square-mile area for 30 years. Does that make any sense? I mean, how does that happen? They weren't talking about a hot, sandy place or a physical desert. The word desert is a code word for the unconscious. Most people live unconsciously until about the age of 40 when they start to wake up and go, maybe something else is going on here. And they begin to do what it takes to leave the desert or the state of unconsciousness, being driven by the generational patterns. Now, you go back to that story and read it through to completion. And what did it take to get out of the desert? What did the Jews have to do to get out of the desert? They said the old generation had to die off. Now, that didn't mean everybody in old physical bodies had to physically die. The root of the word generation, genaria, means cause. All of the causes held in the genes, the desert, the unconscious, had to be resolved before one could live as a conscious spiritual being made of the stuff called love. And it's forgiveness that empties the desert or the unconscious.
The removal of
Yeshua takes it to another, the removal of the pain, exactly. So Yeshua says, you know, when people are saying, well, what's caused? They caused it. Yeshua says, well, wait a minute. No, here's what you do. Take care of the heart, for out of it are the issues in life. Now, that word heart, we couldn't even translate in the Western world until just a few decades ago when Freud rediscovered the unconscious. The unconscious mind, you know, Freud, you know, they gave him a Nobel Prize for discovering the unconscious. Freud no more discovered the unconscious than fly in the air. Freud rediscovered the unconscious, but the unconscious is an idea that is built right into the syntax of the Aramaic language. So Freud did not discover the unconscious, but he rediscovered it. And now we know that what Yeshua was saying when he said, take care of the heart or the unconscious, he was saying, be careful what's hidden from you in your mind. So he says, take care what you're hiding inside yourself and blaming everybody else for, because that's what's going to become the most powerful force in creating your life. And then he goes on to say, you must forgive from your heart the wrongs of your brother. Now, that's been made to sound from the Greeks like a bleeding heart, saying, you know, forgive from your heart. No, that's not what they were saying. Remember, the word forgive is removal. He's saying you must remove from your unconscious that which you put into your perception of your brain's image of your brother. And when you do that, in this case, you know, you were talking about dad. When you do that, all of a sudden, all of the unresolved pain and trauma that you used to have triggered into activity by dad is no longer there to be triggered. And you can go back and look at dad, the good, the bad, and the ugly that was done, and hold that in that space of love instead of holding it out of what's stored and unresolved in your carbon-based memory.
That's exactly what happened with my dad and I. By the time he passed, he and I were friends. And when I saw him, it was a joyful thing. And I remember one of the last things he did, he and I were going to help my brother-in-law do something. And he pulled up to the edge of the driveway in the car. And when he got out of the car, he had this big smile on his face when he saw me. And he said, there's my boy. And he was so excited, and so was I, because all of that stuff that you're talking about, all of that's removed. It was gone. And he and I were friends. And it was incredible.
Awesome. So then from that story, let me just make a wild, educated guess. If you were to go back and look at all the years of trauma that you had with him, would the primary thing you wanted from him was to embrace you in love as his son?
You know, I'm going to tie that into something that happened for me when I was with you at Heartland. We did a conscious connected breathing or still point breathing with you. And one of the things that got confronted in that breathing session was my anger with my dad. And after the session, you said to me, I hope I never forget this. You said to me, Johnny, you don't even know why you're angry with him. And I started rattling off the stories, and you said, that's not why you're angry with him. That's not at all why you're angry with him. And I said, okay, wise guy, why was I angry with him? You said, because he wouldn't let you love him. And when you said that, I broke down, because it was the truth, because all I ever really wanted was for he and I to love each other, and we could not. What's really strange that I know today, we always loved each other, but we were terrified to access it because our stories told us that love couldn't be trusted. So, but by the time that he passed, he and I had removed all that, and we had a great relationship. And today, sometimes when I'm sitting at the house by myself watching one of the old TV shows that I used to watch with my dad, I imagine him sitting here with me and us just having popcorn together. And it's a very loving experience.
Sweet, sweet. So now let me just ask a question or two. If you look at that point where you were able to come back together, and there's that directive that comes out of the Greek teachings, translations of Yeshua's work, where they say to us, you've got to love your brother, or in this case, you've got to love your dad. And my input is, that was never said. That's a totally false command and an impossibility. Because remember, go back to holding the newborn. Is the newborn loving you? No, the newborn is love. Vladimir Lenin says, you know, here's a guy who's responsible for more deaths in all of human history than anybody else. And he says, if you want to destroy a culture, you change the meaning of its words. When love was changed from a noun, who we are, to a verb, the ability to be love was pretty much destroyed. And then we started to strive to do something. Think back to that day when Dad pulled up and said, "There's my son." Were you loving him, or were you standing and basking in the state of love as he did the same, and the two were able to join in love?
Yeah, that feels right. That makes sense.
Yeah. When we're given the directive, if we have a carbon-based memory system, a body-mind unit that's filled with hostility, fear, rage, guilt, grief, drama, and trauma, and somebody comes along and says, "Well, just love your neighbor," and your neighbor comes to you through a law called the law of resonance. You know, resonance is a law of energy exchange. And what resonance does is it creates emotion. You know, one of the simplest examples is I take a tuning fork, a middle C tuning fork, and I hit it on the desk and I put it near a second middle C tuning fork. What happens to the second tuning fork? Without touching it, it starts to vibrate.
Right.
It starts to move.
Right.
If I have two baby grand pianos, I go over to this one, I hit middle C, and I open the top of the second baby grand, and I look, hundreds of strings in there, but the only strings moving are going to be the ones connected to that middle C. Resonance creates motion. In the human realm, resonance creates motion toward. So if I have all kinds of unresolved rage, grief, guilt, drama, and trauma, through resonance, I'm going to cause someone to move toward me. With an attitude that, unless that person is fully conscious, is going to be determined through resonance. And so let's say that what's up for me today is rage. I'm going to find all kinds of neighbors who I'm going to say, "Boy, they enraged me so much." But in truth, that neighbor just showed up and showed me the part of my mind that I need to heal. To tell someone when their rage is up to love someone else is a joke and a travesty because you just set them up for failure. Now, when you inform people that love is what you are and the neighbor shows up resonating your rage, you can stop, you can breathe and go, "Remembering who I am is love and noticing that I have rage up, Charlie, what you just said just brought so much rage up for me, and I realize that's a piece of work I need to do. Thanks for showing up. Now I'm following Yeshua's directive. Be love in the presence of your neighbor, not love your neighbor."
I like it.
And so when I get the words right, then I have signals that I can send to my brain that I can accomplish. You know, my full-blown, most horrible rage can be in the surface, and at the same time, I can be standing back there as a witness and the observer in a state of being and love and going, "Wow, I don't know how I'm going to resolve all this rage at this moment, but I know it's there to be done. And Charlie, my neighbor who showed me this rage, much as there's a part of me that wants to break into this rage toward you, I realize it's mine, and I'm going to go to work on it. Thanks for showing it to me. By the way, Charlie, what did I bring up for you?" Now, Charlie's probably going to say, "My matching bag of garbage," if he's at all responsible and conscious. And he's going to say, "Well, my rage is up too." Now we have a perfect opportunity for two people who can support each other in the forgiveness of rage. Because as long as it's in hiding, it can't be changed. That's why that day in that still point session, that's why we use the breath. You notice when people are in denial and dissociation, the mechanical way they hide information from themselves inside themselves is by holding the breath.
Right.
When you reapply the breath properly, which is a still point process, you start uncovering all those things. And when you uncover something that is unlike love in the presence of active love, that something begins to dissolve. That's the forgiveness process. Now, when they said to Yeshua, "Okay, you know, I tried that and I got rid of some of that rage, but here I am back with it again with that guy. You know, how many of these worksheets do I have to do anyway? How many times should I forgive?" Peter says to him. And Yeshua says, we're told, Peter asks, "Is 7 times enough?" And we're told that Yeshua said 7 times 70, but in Aramaic, he actually said 77 times 70. Now, you can bet that a bunch of fishermen out by the Sea of Galilee weren't going, "Let's see, 7 is 40, did I carry the 4? How many times do I need to forgive?" He wasn't talking about a literal number. He was saying that each individual is going to do as much work as they need to around these layers. And if you're dealing with rage from a family system that's filled with rage for 100 generations, it's going to take time. It's not going to be done overnight. It's a process. It's not an event. And it's going to go piece by piece by piece. And, you know, when you start realizing, you know, the scriptures talk about 3 to 4 generations, 4 generations is 31 lives. In your genetic structure, in a ready for active state, are all the thoughts, feelings, perceptions, experiences, and realities of 31 people in your bloodline. You, mom and dad, mom and dad's mom and dad's in the previous generation. Now, when you start realizing that, where did the fourth generation back get their thoughts, their feelings, their perceptions, their ability to construct the world they see? Well, they obviously got it from the previous four. Who got it from the previous four? Who got it from? Who got it from? Who got it from? If you sit down and do the math in your bloodline, in your genes, in 30 generations, there are over 1.7 billion people. There's work to be done. It takes time. It's a process. My experience over the years is that for the average person, and you might just think back over this, for the average person who's exposed to this level of understanding, it takes somewhere between 5 and 10 years for them to really comprehend it and consciously, purposely go for it, to overcome the unconsciousness in the mind that keeps the hostility and fear moving. And it's an unfolding process. It doesn't happen overnight. And one has to stick with doing their work in order to reach that state where they have freed themselves from sufficient hostility and fear that there's room for love, the being that they are, to incarnate within their forms, to literally come to earth.
Wow.
And it's a process. And that, to me, is the project. That's the work.
Yeah, and it has definitely been a process for me, and it's gone on for much more than 10 years. I started my recovery process in 1984 in the 12-step fellowships, and that was a door opening for me to come do the work like I did with you and the other work that I've done. And I've done a lot of the breathing work in many different ways that I believe expedited my recovery. I have no idea. I cannot put a number on how much that helped speed things up for me, really letting go and releasing the, man, I was so angry for so long. And
well, let's go back.
Go ahead.
Let's go back and listen to the Aramaic creation story where the Greeks tell us God sent out his spirit. In Aramaic, it doesn't say that. It says God sent out his breath. And remember the story of John the Baptist, and he's baptizing people in water, and he says, one is going to come after you that will baptize you in the spirit. The word was breath. That's the baptism. You look at, you're familiar with the Pentecostal story, you know, where the tongues of fire appear over the disciples' heads and all of that. Now, the Greeks tell us that Yeshua breathed on them. It's not what it says in Aramaic. In Aramaic, it says Yeshua breathed them. Baptism by breath. That is, the washing, the flushing, the cleaning out of the rage, the guilt, the grief, the fear, the generational patterns that never belonged. So it's a key step in the process. Few will ever come to a completion point without the breath.
Right, right. I know.
I like to refer to it as a super processor.
Right. What I've always said to try to simplify my explanation of what that did for me, it's like putting my recovery in a microwave because it's like it just does stuff. That and healing that you can't do in cognitive therapy just sitting and talking. One of the things you taught that you teach in your thing is about cellular memory and how we hold all those energies in our body, and until those are released, then we're still holding it.
Right, exactly. In my codependence to interdependence work, I identify what I call the 8 pseudo solutions of the non-being mind. And they're the things that, you know, the intellect thinks will work us through it. And the number one pseudo solution is, if I could just figure this out. You can't figure it out. I don't care what you do. When you start realizing that what you're weaving together to form your body and to form your perceptual ability is 1,000 generations of carbon-based memory expressing all that weaving, all those dynamics, you just cannot figure that out with your mind. You can't do it. But you can forgive it. You can enter into the process of collapsing the end result perception that comes from all of that. And when it collapses in on itself. And when it collapses in on itself, then you can bring love to the presence of that, and the dissolution begins. That's when it starts to disappear and is washed or flushed out of the system.
Wow. Michael, could you take a minute to tell the audience a little more about how the still point breathing works, since we touched on that?
Actually, what my experience is over the years is that in order for people to take instruction on still point, it has to be personal, because you don't know what's going to start to move.
Right.
And without proper facilitation, things can get really crazy. So I never give instructions on still point. I have nothing written about it. I have a video called Mind Shifter, is one of the tools we use, an introduction to still point breathing, but it's only an introduction. I only do the instructions on a one-to-one basis when I'm there to actually facilitate somebody and introduce them to it. Ultimately, it's a process that's meant to be used for themselves, by themselves. So I would not hand the instructions to newbie and say, go breathe yourself. I just wouldn't do it.
Well, that wasn't actually what I was talking about, because I know that there is no way that I would, as many times as I've done it, I actually still want somebody to be present with me when I'm doing it. I don't want to go through I want somebody there. What I was asking for, more than how it works, is what it does, what it actually does for the breather.
So if you think about, you know, there's some interesting Harvard research that says that in a time frame where 10,000 brain cells fire, the max amount of information that goes into conscious awareness is 9 bits. Little tiny, tiny fragment. Now, if you recognize that literally the whole world that you see is a product of perception. The world has taught us a fallacy. The world has taught us that we have a pair of windows. We look out through them and we see what's going on out there. The eyes are a one-way valve. Information comes in, nothing goes out, nobody sees out through their eyes. Information comes in, and that information that comes in stimulates brain cells, and the firing of brain cells, and they're actually starting to come up with the math that shows how this is done, the firing of brain cells structures a perceptual world, an image. That's why, you know, six different people can be in an accident. You know, you're in the courtroom listening and you wonder if any two of them were at the same accident. Right. No two of them were at the same accident. The external world, the actuality was the same, but the reality in each mind was different. Now, when you start realizing underneath that 9 bits of data that create the world we see, literally, the perceptual world that we see. And if anybody wants to look at a little more detailed explanation of that, I've got a video on my YouTube page, and folks can get to the video by going to our website, which is whyagain.org. And on the right-hand side are all the social media links, and the bottom one is YouTube. If you click on that YouTube link, you'll be on my YouTube channel. There are over 100 videos there. But look down the list for a title. It's actually got a picture of the cover of my book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And the title is, What is the World? It's ACIM. It's a lesson from the course. ACIM, What is the World? What is Forgiveness? It's about a 35-minute lesson on this topic, moving into forgiveness. But literally, our minds are structuring the world that we call visual, that we think we're looking at. And that visual is an internal process. Now, if anybody thinks that they can figure out or unravel all of the genetic resonance that goes into constructing that speck that we see, think again, because we just don't have the capacity to do that. But what the breath does is that the breath begins the unraveling process. And when the breath is done in the presence of active love, then the active love reinforces the unraveling process and just takes us deeper and deeper and deeper into regions of the mind that nobody is ever going to figure out. But love corrects them.
And I've always said that because of my early beginnings with my turnaround and my spiritual growth, I've always said we don't really see what we look at. We see what we look for, because we send out messengers that A Course in Miracles talks about to support what we think we want to see, right?
Yes.
So,
and
if there's a violent world, I'm gonna see a violent world, and I'm gonna be in an unsafe place. But when I start coming from that place of love, then that's more of what I see.
Exactly. I believe it was Thoreau that said, what we look at is not what's important, it's what we see.
Right.
And we see constructs, everything we look at. In fact, you know, this is a principle that I've taught for decades in my work, but about 3 years ago, I came across a book on the CIA's website. You can go and download their study of perception at CIA.gov. And if you go to their website and take a look, you'll read, and I don't know how many millions of dollars they spent studying perception to try to get, you know, the best intelligence they could get out of their intelligence agents. And one of the things that they say out of their study of perception is the mind does not record reality. The mind generates reality.
Beautiful.
Each of us generates. This is a CIA. The mind generates the world we see. Everybody and the realities that are generated by the mind always tell us more about the contents of the mind than the world we think we're looking at. Once you get that one and you say, I realize that I'm designed to function as the active presence of love, and what I'm seeing, which reflects the contents of my mind, is pain, fear, rage, guilt, grief, et cetera, et cetera. Then maybe it's time for me to go to work and change that game rather than get lost in believing that it's all out there, because it's not out there. It's in here.
You know, that all ties into the tagline for our show that we're on here, Morph Into a New You. And that is, if you want to change your life, you got to change your mind about your life. And
yes,
it's very simple. There's so much of this work we do that the truth is, if I can open my mind to what's going on, to a new way of seeing things, it's really, a lot of it's really pretty simple, but we want to make it very complex. So,
it's all very simple. Yeah, the healing process is very simple. It's just not always easy.
Right. Exactly.
Big difference. Facing those things, allowing yourself to be with those things and allowing them to surface can get pretty crazy.
Right.
And if you have the tools and use the tools.
To me, that's why it's important that we do these things in groups, because that connectivity of having someone else standing there with me in their pain, showing me, letting me see their pain, and vice versa, the joining in that place becomes very powerful and incredibly healing. I can't say enough about the work I've done in groups where people were basically becoming emotionally naked with each other, and it's like, okay, this is the real me that I think is a real me. Help me discover the real me, which is the love that you've been talking about.
Right. Let's look at this idea that you're talking about in the context of relationships. And sadly, the moment where the deepest healing is ready to happen in relationships is usually the moment where people cut and run, head the other direction. You know, the body-mind unit has a built-in suppress mechanism. Let's imagine we've got a vitality meter. It goes from 1 to 10. And somebody's at a level 5 vitality, and they have a level 7 toxin. And they say, man, I want to work through this issue with my father. Man, I want to get rid of it. I want to deal with this one. But at a level 5 vitality, if I had to have a toxin that's a level 7 and it were to release, it could literally kill me. It's not going to happen. It's not until I get to a level 7.5 that I'm going to be able to really let that surface and work through it. So let's imagine we have two people in relationship and they're each at a level 5, which means that they've got traumas at a level 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. When the two of them really, truly connect out of that space of love, together their vitality goes to a level 10. And what happens? All hell breaks loose. And each one says, points the finger at the other one, says, well, I don't experience this unless I'm around you. And what it really means is, I'm not vital enough to look at my own junk unless I'm connected to the love that you are. And because I don't know any better, I blame you for what I'm feeling. If we realize the principles and that when two people join in the space of love, that their stuff's going to come up, then you make it safe enough for that to happen and it moves through. And then, of course, you take a group of people. You get 10, 20, 30, 50 people together that are doing that level of work, and you have extreme levels of vitality in that space. And in those extreme levels of vitality, work can be done that will never be done in isolation on one's own. Right. One will never set them up to do themselves up to do that level of work. They've got their ways, you know, well, gee, you know, I really don't want to feel this. So let me go have a shot of caffeine and sugar and phosphoric acid. They call that Coke.
Right. And
I don't really want to do this. Let me smoke a joint. Oh, I don't want to do this. Give me a cup of that caffeine and give me about 3 teaspoons of sugar with it. And by the way, throw in a little bit of that cow pus that congests things so that I don't have to move this energy and don't deal with it. And that's basically, we're the most drug culture that's ever existed on the face of the earth. And it's time for us to get free of our drugs and get vital enough, because drugs weaken. You know, we have a big argument going on in the culture right now about healthcare. There's no healthcare in America, or virtually none. It's all disease care. It's all about symptom suppression. If somebody was handing out something that is really has to do with healthcare, they would not hand it to you and say, oh, here's something that will improve your symptoms. And by the way, it'll cause this body part to fall off. This part might never work again. And by the way, check with your doctor because you may experience sudden death. That's not healthcare. That's symptom suppression. That's weakening people so that they don't feel what it is that's going on. If someone had an actual healthcare product, they'd hand it to you and say, this is going to vitalize absolutely everything in your structure and everything in your system. You're going to go through some healing symptoms, but man, you're going to love this. There are no body parts that are going to fall off and things are going to rock. That's healthcare.
Right.
The other's disease care.
And that thing that you were talking about just a minute ago about, you know, how we bring things up for each other and basically offer each other the opportunity to heal, that's where the appreciation part of what I've called forgiveness comes in. Because if I'm really conscious of what's going on, when somebody brings something up for me, they're bringing me a gift or bringing me the opportunity to heal and to grow. And that's where the appreciation comes in for me. That's why I feel the way I do about my dad today, because I totally shifted that around to where I saw him as a bearer of a gift instead of an ogre that was there to destroy my life. And so, yeah, that's where I appreciate. Now, when I'm standing in the presence of somebody standing on my toe, do I appreciate them right there? Probably not. But that is the goal. Okay, you showed me my upset. There's a line in one of the 12-step books that says, whenever someone has done something to disturb us, something has always gone wrong with us. And what that means, I don't like some of the verbiage there, but I do love the point. The point is, it's me. My upset isn't what you've done. My upset is within me. And
exactly.
That's even started for me in my 12-step training 30-some years ago. But the truth is always there. And, Michael, I hate to do this. I'm watching the clock, and this has been a great conversation. But I'm going to have to get you to give us all of your contact information and what all you're doing and how to get your book. And we need to close up with that. And I'll just go ahead and tell the audience now that we will definitely have Michael on here again, and we will continue this conversation.
Well, if people want support and want to know more about what I'm doing, then go to my website, whyagain.org. And the first two words on the page say, start here. If they click that, it'll walk them through a whole tutorial, no cost, free, to take them through the forgiveness process. If they start to utilize the process, and there are many other tools on my website as well, 5 days a week from 1 till 2 o'clock Eastern time, I do a radio show that there's a link. People can listen to it on their computers. Or they can phone into the show, as with this one, and the call-in number is 563-999-3581. We travel 6 to 10 months of the year. We're actually getting ready to head to North Carolina. We'll be doing a 16-day codependence to interdependence intensive in Lansing, Michigan in October. We've got a 7-bedroom, 6.5-bath house on the beach in Oak Island, North Carolina. March and April, we'll be doing intensives there. And then Heartland is our teaching center in the Ozarks in southern Missouri. And next summer, we'll be doing intensives at Heartland. So people can tap into the radio show. They can download the forgiveness worksheet. We call it the wake-up sheet. They can download over 7 years of archives of radio shows on our website. And they're welcome to call 5 days a week, an hour a day, 1 till 2 o'clock. And they'll be having a conversation with us, and we'll carry on this conversation and offer all the support we can. We have a catalog of tapes and books available as well. That's on our website. And we're just delighted to support people. And by the way, when we travel and teach, we pay our own expenses, and our workshops are done free. So we go anywhere on the globe we're invited. So that's how to reach us.
Great. Thank you, Michael. I want to thank you so much. This was a great conversation. It's, you know, 27 years ago is when you and I first connected, and it's been a long haul. So I just want to thank you for what you've done. and all that you do. And I want to say thanks to all of our listeners for tuning in, and stay in touch, because we will definitely have Michael back on here. Thank you.
Delighted. Blessings. Bye-bye.
Okay, everybody. Thanks for listening. Remember, never give up. Always keep it real and take time to smell the roses. And please sit down and watch a butterfly. Keep up with all that we are doing by going to morphintoanewyou.com. Thank you very much.